I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It turns out one of the best places in the world today to buy a shiny new car is China. $4,000 buys you a brand new Geely, a car that might not match a silver Mercedes in styling or price, but they are both on the streets of Shanghai, symbols of change in a country that most of us wouldn't recognize. Buildings are being torn down and streets are being torn up to make room for the onslaught of autos. The bicycle's no longer cool. It's a 2-, 4-, 6-, and 8-cylinder revolution that's changing the way Chinese shop and travel and live. And this boom in urban wealth is having its political consequences as well. China is, after all, still a one-party state, still run by the communists. Those politicians are meeting this week to try to make the necessary constitutional changes so China can adapt to this newfound wealth. It is once again the irony of communists embracing private property and adapting the constitution to cope with personal wealth and entrepreneurs. These same politicians are also promising to try to level the economic field somewhat, allowing the hundreds of millions of rural peasants to get their share of the boom. So, who is really in charge in China? Can the communists and the capitalists continue to work together? And what does this economic change mean for political change? Can one happen without the other? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we'll speak with a number of guests this hour about the future of capitalism in communist China. We're going to start at the center of China's wealth, the city of Shanghai, and there, in Shanghai, with the premier global monitor of such wealth, Forbes magazine. Russell Flannery is the Forbes bureau chief. He's joining us on the line. Hi, Russell.
Good morning.
Now, Forbes opened its China bureau in Shanghai just a little over a year ago. I wonder what the great leader would have to say about that.
Well, it's quite a statement that we're here smack in the middle of things. China, of course, has come a long way in a very short time. When you look at Chinese history, the reforms that are created all the car consumption and all the lavish spending that you just described are only 25 years old, and much of that has really built up steam in only the last several years.
Now, one of the things, Russell, that you're working on is a rich list, a list of the wealthiest Chinese business people or entrepreneurs. Is there a threshold for people to qualify for that list?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, the first time that we published this list was in an overseas edition in 1995, and we've been publishing it annually in our English language international edition and our domestic edition of Forbes every year since 1999. Each year, that lower threshold has gone up as we've discovered more of China's rich out there. Last year, to be on the list, you had to be worth at least $100 million.
Wow. Now, are these people, Russell, heroes in China?
Well, good question. China actually these days is embracing entrepreneurism and embracing international success and embracing wealth. So on the one hand, the entrepreneurs that are on our list are important agents of change and important job creators and important benefactors for their communities, and that are all admired for that. On the other hand, because there's been so much change here in such a short period of time, you also find a very widespread ambivalence among people about the accumulation of that kind of wealth. So it's on one hand, it's a kind of on one hand, but on the other hand, situation.
Give me an example of one of these characters and an example of the places where they're making their money.
Well, one of the big trends on the rich list last year was the growing number of people that came from the electronics industry in the internet space. As you may know, China today is has the world's number two base of internet users, and there's a whole world of applications and content out there that's been constructed for Chinese users Many of the companies that are winning in that industry here are also listing on overseas stock exchanges, including the NASDAQ. For instance, Sohu and NetEase and Sina, the big three internet portals, are all listed in New York. And two of the main founders of those three companies that I just mentioned were on our China Rich list last year. Number one, in fact, was the founder of New York traded NetEase.
And tell me something, Russell, in a country that has so much wealth but still such a sort of patchwork of regulation, how hard is it for you and your people as journalists to figure out who's got the money in China these days?
Well, another interesting trend that we discovered last year is that more and more people that made our list are raising money offshore. And for instance, about 40-45% of the total of the 100 people that we had on our list had at least one listed company, had at least one of their companies listed on an overseas stock exchange. And there's a very interesting and important reason for that, which is that globalization is really reshaping China. Imports are increasing, exports are increasing, direct foreign investment, as you probably know, has really been gushing in here, and it's changing people's ideas and about the world, and certainly having a big impact on the way things get done. So just to come back to your question, the companies that are raising money overseas are typically very transparent. They've been through overseas regulatory procedures. They may have disclosures to the Hong Kong Stock
Right.
Exchange or New York, and so that kind of wealth is relatively easy to get at. On the other hand, as you imply, there's also a great swath of wealth here that is not so easy to get at, and because some of the feelings about wealth in society, a lot of those people are reluctant to raise their hand and talk about their success.
Interesting time to be doing what you're doing in that country. Russell, good of you to join us this morning.
Thank you very much for having us.
Russell Flannery is Forbes China Bureau Chief, speaking to us there live from Shanghai. Let's go to Beijing, the capital of the country. Rob Gifford, NPR's China correspondent, joins us from his ISDN connection there. Rob, good to have you back on the program.
Hi there, Dick. How are you?
I'm well. Now, you've been in China some 4 years now. Is that right, Rob?
That's right.
What would you point to in Beijing as perhaps the most visible, most recent symbol of this kind of wealth that we're seeing in the cities in China?
I think you'd have to point to the cars on the roads. I mean, you mentioned it in your introduction. I mean, I went away on vacation for a month last summer, and it seemed to me when I came back as though the number of automobiles on the roads had almost doubled. I mean, that wasn't quite true, but it felt like it. And in fact, 70%, there was a 70% increase of cars, passenger cars in China purchased last year. And you really feel that. I mean, China, Beijing, and Shanghai and Guangzhou have become like other Asian cities. This gridlock used to take me 20 minutes to get to work. I'm now lucky if I get there within 50. And really, that is such a sort of sign of the aspirations of many Chinese people. That's a symbol of new wealth. And everyone has got their cell phone. They've got their laptop. And so now, of course, they want to have a car.
And how's the driving? Are people gracious and ready to let you go in front of them?
Don't ask. There's a lot of high blood pressure here among foreigners, I'll put it that way.
Rob, the Communist Party plenum is also on this week. Late last week, the speechifying began, and I'm curious to know in tracking the wealth, as you do for NPR, whether or not it is equally important to watch what it is the politicians are trying to do to keep track or to restrain or guide this at all. Are the two operating in parallel universes, or are the politicians actually working on these issues?
Oh, I think they definitely are, and we've seen that over the last few days with these announcements in the National People's Congress, the annual meeting of China's of Parliament. What often happens in China, and we've seen it over the last 25 years, is things happen down in the countryside, especially, or things happen in the cities, you know, miles away from Beijing, and they get sort of tested out, and then that happened with the household responsibility system after Communism. Someone just decided they were going to sell their own grain in the market. And then several years after that, the Communist Party suddenly realized, hey, maybe that would work. And they sort of ratified it at the center. That's happening now also in many other areas. And one of the areas is in the protection of private property rights. That's one of the things that is being written into the Constitution of the People's Republic of China this week. Private property rights. Think how contradictory that is to the whole concept of communism. But all the things we've been talking about, the ownership of cars and cell phones and apartments, they are, you know, they've pushed the Communist Party into realizing that it has to recognize that people have private property and they want it protected. So there is this sort of dialogue between officialdom and reality, if you like, the man on the street. And I think the Communist Party slowly picks up on where it has to go. The problem is that the political change is often a lot slower than the reality on the street.
Any sense from the Communist Party officials, though, that they fear the power of the entrepreneurs once they get their private property rights? I mean, I'm thinking of the tension that exists right now in Russia between the industrialists and the politicians there. Is that something people in China are talking about?
Absolutely. And I think if you look at the history of any country that has democratized, you'll see, you know, starting back in medieval Europe, I mean, you'll see them. It's the merchants who have often formed these sort of power bases outside the king or the emperor or the ruling party's control. And so what the Chinese government has done to prevent this happening is they've tried to bring all these entrepreneurs inside the tent. In your introduction there, you talked about, you know, the communists and the capitalists. Are they at odds with each other? Well, right. In fact, the communists are the capitalists. That's the great amazing thing about modern China. They're not two different sets of people.
Yes,
so
okay.
The party has brought the entrepreneurs inside the tent so that they'll be part of the status quo, that they'll have a sort of interest in maintaining the status quo and in pushing the Communist Party line. Now, as China diversifies, it's going to be interesting to see whether that can be sustained, because I'm not sure that the interests of each of those groups is going to be compatible, you know, say 10 years down the line. But certainly they're working hard and they're very aware of these problems. They're very aware. They're much more, I think, linked into the problems that China is facing than people think. And certainly Wen Jiabao, the premier's statements over the last few days about rural poverty would seem to suggest that. They really know that there is still a lot of rural poverty despite all the wealth in the cities, and they really are trying to do something to address that.
And that has more to do, as much to do with just self-preservation, right? I need you to be quick on this because we're coming up to the break, Rob.
Yes, it does. It's very much a matter of self-preservation. They don't want to have a rural rebellion on their hands. But to be fair to them, I think this new group of leaders do have some sympathy for the peasants, much more than the previous leaders.
Rob, thanks so much for being with us. Great to hear from you.
Thanks very much, Dick. Bye.
Rob Gifford is National Public Radio's correspondent joining us there from Beijing. When we come back after the break, we will take this one step further. As Rob so elegantly corrects me now, the communists are the capitalists. Who's at the front? Who's got their hands on the steering wheel at this point? We're going to talk about that funny mix of politics and private enterprise in that country at this moment. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like you to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Think about this with me for a minute now. Who really is in charge in China as we are tracking an economy that is as powerful and moving as quickly as that one is? And we note in this country, in an election year, stealing jobs from people in this country, something that has gone on for a while. Can the capitalist communists keep this economy on the rails? And as we look at economic change happening so quickly there, can the politicians keep track Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. And I'd like to introduce my two guests for the balance of the hour. Doug Guthrie is an associate professor of sociology at New York University, author of a book called Dragon in a Three-Piece Suit, The Emergence of Capitalism in China. He's joining us from a studio at Stanford University. Doug, good of you to be with us.
Good morning.
And Min-Ching Pei is Senior Associate and Director of the China Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's joining us from a studio at National Public Radio in Washington. Min-Ching, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
I'd like to, Min-Ching, perhaps start with you and just coming straight off what Rob Gifford was talking about. When we look at the fact that the plenum is happening this particular week, the politicians are scratching their heads over what to do about the economy, I'm reminded of an earlier meeting, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago, you're better with the history than me, when the politicians got together and they said, well, the country would be ruled according to law. And everybody looks back at that and says, well, that's ridiculous. They passed that and it never was and it still isn't. It isn't in many ways a country which, you know, obeys its own laws. So how much credibility, how much power do the politicians have?
Well, you have to look at rhetoric and then look at the reality. Obviously, the rhetoric is one thing and Chinese reality is another. In the case of politicians in China, we must remember that China is a huge country. Central leaders have very limited influence on the ground in remote areas. So although this week we've heard very encouraging words from Premier Wen Jiabao to the effect that the central government will reduce rural taxation and eventually eliminate one kind of taxes, we should be careful whether this policy will actually lead to a lot of improvement in rural areas. In the past, as in the case of the government's promise of pushing legal reform, the government also promised to reduce rural taxation. Eventually, very few promises were carried out.
And so, Doug Guthrie, do you pay any attention to what the Communist Party plenum people talk about, or are you basically watching what's happening on the street in Shanghai to track that country's future?
Well, I think I agree with what Min-Ching just said in that there is a rhetorical aspect of what's going on in Beijing. I guess the only thing I would add to that is that that rhetoric in many ways does signal both things that are going to happen in the future and things that have been underway on some level. China is an incredibly decentralized place, and that does make it very difficult for policies in Beijing or rhetoric in Beijing to actually translate into policy. But as your correspondent in Beijing pointed out, China goes through a process of experimentation long before rhetoric actually hits the headlines. And so many things actually are happening on the ground.
Give me an example of what you mean, Doug, something that was experimented with before it became enshrined in any kind of policy.
Well, virtually every aspect of the economic reforms. I mean, if you think, for example, about something like labor contracts, which became codified in the labor law in 1994, the state started, at the local level, started experimenting with putting people on labor contracts as early as 1983. Similarly, with the village-level elections, which were codified in law in maybe 1998 or 99, those were being experimented with as early as 1987. And so the experimentation happens, kinks are worked out, the process of kind of implementation occurs, and then eventually it gets codified in law, which is a very different development model than a lot of other transforming communist countries have gone through.
And so, Min-Ching, would you say then that the politicians are in many ways just trying to keep pace with the changes that are happening rather than guiding the economy?
Oh, definitely, because China, when it began to reform more than 25 years ago, was really entering uncharted territory. There was no book about how to reform a socialist economy. Today, of course, we know a lot more. But since then, China has unleashed a very dynamic society. And the changes that have taken place, I mean, nobody have predicted that China would have done so well. Let's
right.
just be frank about this. However, on the other side, you also see that those changes have brought benefits as well as undesirable effects on Chinese society in terms of inequality, in terms of governance capabilities, and many other issues. So the government has to constantly catch up with the trend. And here I think the biggest challenge is in the political realm. Today, the Chinese government essentially has the same or more or less the same decision-making structure as it had 25 years ago, although there has been a lot of decentralization. But this sort of top-down, relatively centralized decision-making structure does not really suit the country really well.
1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join our conversation as we try to keep track of the pace of economic and political change in China. Let's go to Greenville, North Carolina. Jason's joining us on the line. Jason, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
So what are you thinking?
Well, I'm just curious. You're obviously doing this story for a reason, and I'm hoping the reason is this will benefit us. And I'm just curious if it will.
You mean as China succeeds, is that good for the American economy?
Exactly.
Doug Guthrie, how do you track the two? What would you say to Jason?
I think clearly we are in an era of globalized and interdependent economies. And at this point, on many levels, we need China as much as China needs us. And there is obviously a lot of concern about jobs going overseas and a number of different aspects of that. But one of the things that is really important about China that perhaps you could think of in contrast to Japan's economic development in the 1960s and 70s is that the Chinese economy is actually much more open than a lot of people realize. I mean, the companies that are among the top earners in China, among the top 40, about 10 are American multinationals that have access to internal markets there that and that's only going to continue to grow. It's an aspect of the Chinese society that we've been sort of waiting for as China entered into the WTO. And so on some level, there's a lot of uncertainty because we hear about the trade deficit and or the trade imbalance and the extent to which the Chinese economy is really an engine of Asia that is sort of the counterbalance to the U.S. economy. But I think in many ways, the access to opportunity there, I mean, that's the reason so many foreign multinationals want to be there is the myth of the billion-person marketplace is really a myth that they hope becomes reality.
But may I add something?
Yeah, please go ahead.
I think for the United States as a whole, China's growth and integration into the international trading system is definitely good. However, for certain individuals or certain groups, especially in the manufacturing sector, China's emergence poses enormous challenge. It is not necessarily that good. But when we look at the political effects of this kind of change within the U.S., you will find that those who are hurt by China's competition tend to be politically more organized because they're much more concentrated. On the other hand, the benefits created by China's integration and by China's trade with the U.S. are widely dispersed. These are consumers. Mm-hmm. Nobody will organized to protest that DVD prices are going up because there's protection against China.
There would be no $29 DVD without China.
Oh, $29, yeah. So because if you take China out of the picture, you're not going to get $29 DVDs. You're going to see prices in Walmart go up quite a bit. That will hurt American consumers.
Let me ask you, though, both to weigh in on something that people don't seem to be able to agree on, and that is whether or not China can just keep going at 7%, 8%, and 9% growth with the industrialists charging ahead, the politicians running behind, sort of repairing the Constitution to keep pace. I mean, even, Minjin, let me ask you to start on this. Even on the point of private property, I mean, private property, if they actually get it enshrined in law, and if that is respected, promises to take away a great amount of the power that the politicians have to maintain their one-party state. So are they really serious about giving the ordinary people that much clout?
I think some people in the government are serious about protecting private property and trying to do something in practice to make sure it happens. On the other hand, for the Communist Party as a whole, I'm not so sure. Because as Bob Gifford said, that throughout history, we have seen this pattern. An independent property-owning class eventually will acquire political power. And that kind of situation is not really good for a political ruling party intent upon preserving its power forever. So this much history or theory aside, I see several big obstacles ahead in terms of making protected private property meaningful in Chinese economic life. The first is the government still maintains a lot of control over a wide range of economic activities. These activities will have to be further liberalized. Second and more important is that the Communist Party still maintains control over the Chinese judiciary through appointments, through funding.
Right.
And without changing this situation, then you are not going to have the courts in China who will be an effective instrument in protecting private property.
All right, Doug, when we look at the possibility that there's a split in the Communist Party here, the natural conclusion is that some point in the future, what is very stable in China, that is the totalitarian state, is going to become unstable. The investors will flee, China's growth will stop, and the whole thing will come shuddering to a stop. Is that a scenario that you see as likely or possible?
I think it's extremely unlikely. I think the naysayers about China's growth pattern and its approach to development, which has belied all of the predictions and arguments about how you can do gradual reform in a transforming socialist economy, have proven that wrong. I mean, it's just simply not the case that the country is on the verge of falling apart. I think one of the things that's interesting about the Communist Party, despite the fact that it is struggling to keep up with what's actually going on in an incredibly dynamic economy and society, is that it has proved to be dynamic enough that it is able to respond to the changes that are afoot. And, you know, I think particularly the new era of leaders who are one generation beyond looking over their shoulders at Tiananmen and what happened to Zhao Ziyang when he sort of came out for political reform. I think it's clear that this is a really dynamic group of people that certainly have a lot of challenges ahead, but they are responsive enough to the experiments that they're doing in the economy that those things usually play out. Let me just add one more thing about your original question that has to do with sort of the strength of the economy and the prospects for the future is that China has two very interesting advantages in its development. And one of those is that it has an immense cheap labor force. And I think we typically think of that in terms of multinationals going overseas to seek cheap labor. But one of the things that's a key about that in terms of Chinese economic growth is that it won't outgrow its developmental trajectory the way a number of other smaller developing countries did. So take, for example, Taiwan, which over the course of basically a generation eventually outpriced itself in terms of labor costs and, you know, multinationals moved elsewhere. In China, there is an immense labor force to be exhausted, which it will take generations to do. I mean, it's going to take a long time before the economic and before the incomes rise enough that it's going to be outpriced. And the second thing is that if China can develop an indigenous high-tech economy, which it's already sort of clear that it's underway, that's going to really define the difference of whether it's just going to be a large economy or if it's going to be a really powerful economy.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Northampton, Massachusetts. Linda's on the line. Linda.
Good morning. Hi. I wanted to hear you discuss the urban poor. I've heard you mention the rural poor on several occasions, but I have learned that tremendous numbers of people have been moving in from the rural areas into Shanghai and Beijing and so on, and they are not participating in the economy. There are not enough jobs for them. What a potential for political instability is there in that, and who is addressing these problems?
Doug, you were most recently in Shanghai. I wonder if you can help Linda with that. Are we missing a
sure.
part of the picture here if we only talk about the rural poor?
Yeah, she's referring to a group of the population that's typically called the floating population, which is an immense part of the pop. I mean, it's 100 million people. So if you think about that, that's a population the size of, say, Northern Europe or a third of the size of the U.S. that are basically these migrant laborers who move from rural areas into cities. There is a tremendous gap of inequality between the nouveau riche in the cities and even just the sort of middle class in the cities and this group of people. The one caveat I would add to what Linda said is that these people are actually, many of them are participating in the economy, but they are sort of the cheap labor on the backs of which Shanghai and other metropolises are being built. The one thing that's interesting about this group, there's been a fair amount written about the ways in which they are basically second-class citizens. They don't have citizenship rights, and in many ways, that has been true. However, there are, and to give a concrete example, they've been excluded from basic things like access to public education, obviously healthcare and other things, because they're not sort of on the state payroll in the same way that other people who are in the transforming socialist economy were. But one of the things that's been interesting is that the government has started to adapt to this group of people, I think in part because this group was self-organizing in a way that was a little bit surprising for them. So they were starting to organize their own schools, organize their own social institutions. And I think the government's response to that was a little bit frightened by that, because if you have such a large group of population, a group of people that are self-organizing and creating their own social institutions, that's really an institutional threat to the Communist Party. And in recent years, we've started to see that they've been allowing the better integration of this group of people into the social institutions of the urban areas. Still great gaps in terms of wealth and inequality, but it seems to be the case that they're starting to be integrated a little bit more right now.
The numbers, though, are absolutely staggering when you think about it. 900 million people is what we talk about when we're referring to the rural poor in China. And they are relatively well represented by their own political leaders at the party plenum in Beijing. That's why Premier Wen Jiabao is talking about reducing taxes, somehow trying to level a playing field. So is there room for a little bit of socialism in a communist capitalist economy that is banging away at the pace that China is? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'd like to have you join us this hour. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me on the program this hour, Min Jin Pei. He's a senior associate, and co-director of the China Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C., author of a book called From Reform to Revolution, The Demise of Communism in China and the Soviet Union. Doug Guthrie's also with us. His book is called Dragon in a Three-Piece Suit, The Emergence of Capitalism in China. He's an associate professor of sociology at New York University, and we're taking a look at all the economic and the political change that's underway at this moment in China. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Let's go next to Lexington, Massachusetts. David's on the line. David, thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me. I want to know what's going to happen when the Chinese, who number 4 to 5 times as great as the Americans, start all driving cars and eating meat. What's going to happen to the price of gasoline? And what's going to happen to the price of food, which, after all, is highly dependent on petroleum for its production?
I think the price of fuel is a great place to start, Minchin. I was reading something not long ago about China realizing that it didn't have the fuel reserves to refine the gasoline for all the cars that people want to put on the roads. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that particular item. Anyway, I think that the impact of China's prosperity on food prices will probably be very modest, because we know there's a glut in food production capacity around the world. So the world can definitely meet that increasing demand from China. The impact on gasoline prices or on fuel supplies will be tremendous, because China today is already the second largest consumer of petroleum after the U.S. China imports 32% of its oil today. Soon it will be importing 60-70%. And I think in about 6 years, China will be importing 10 million barrels of oil a day. That's about the same as the U.S. So that will put tremendous strain on world supplies. Whether the world can meet that demand, I don't know. But I think for China itself, it will create enormous problems: environment, pollution, traffic. I've been to China many, many times. I do not think China needs that kind of traffic jam.
And the air in Beijing is already pretty awful.
Yeah, well, China is not like the U.S. 70% of China's land is not flat. 70% of American land is flat. In other words, there's a lot less land in China that is suitable for automobile traffic.
Can I ask you, though, just one more question, Minxin, about the land? Because it has me puzzled about the future of empowering these hundreds of millions of people. Does private property, does that kind of reform mean that a farmer is going to be able to take his acre or his hectare of land, borrow a little bit of money against that, and pull himself or his family up that way? Will property rights go right down to include everybody?
No, I think there are several issues here. There are some other forms of property, private property, and rights associated with those properties. But land is very special. Land in China today is not private alone. The government owns the land. Peasants can only lease the land. They have so-called user rights. They do not have ownership rights. So ultimately, the government will have to do something about ownership rights of land. But until the government does that, there are lots of problems with making sure that a peasant who has secure user rights will have their rights respected and protected. Because what's happening today in China is that land owned by peasants can be requisitioned or taken back by the government for other uses,
right,
for industrial development, for opening, developing a highway. So those user rights are not exactly secure. So if we want to have more automobiles in China, some peasants will have to suffer because their land will be taken away.
So is this a flaw in the three-piece suit, Doug? If land ownership is so essential to the capitalist economy in countries where that's not a problem.
I have a little bit of a different perspective on that, in that, again, to go back to the issue of sort of experimentation and implementation, I mean, one of the things that's important to realize about China is that the processes of transformation have happened. There have been reforms without privatization, but that doesn't mean that, as Minxin puts it, user rights and ownership type control doesn't exist. Now, the problem with China is that it's still an authoritarian government, but it's not a communist problem. The problem is that the government can act in a capricious way, but there are lots of effective capitalist economies around the world that are still under the auspice or have been under the auspice of an authoritarian regime.
Right, let's go back to our phone lines to Cape Cod, Massachusetts now. Peter's with us on the phone. Peter, thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. I did have a concern. I've thought about this. I've been to China. I spent maybe a month in Hong Kong. But, all this recent revelation of the government over there and their policy towards their people, I am concerned that the free world might be, I don't know. I don't know if anybody's watching this, but I feel like we may be getting duped by this new policy. I am concerned that we are compromising our future policy towards China's human rights. I mean, we're talking about a country that just is still taking prisoners out in pickup trucks and harvesting body parts. And I think we should be very, very careful when we're turning over so much of the goods that turns up in Walmarts and Kmarts, and essentially our gross national product, and our dependency on a country that has a history of human rights violations, and what that may leave us, you know, in our policy towards that country in the future.
Well, I think it's a good question, Peter. I mean, all my adult life, presidents and prime ministers of the free world, Doug Guthrie, I'm going to put this to you first, have been told that they really can't talk to their counterparts in China without saying the two words human rights first, and that seems to be slipping off the agenda.
It certainly does. I mean, the first, let me just point out that there's a certain hypocrisy on the U.S. side with respect to this issue, and this is not to speak to the caller, but among politicians on this issue. I think many American people care about this very deeply.
Yeah.
The rhetoric that comes out of Washington on it is really problematic. I can tell you that, you know, Jesse Helms, for all of his drumbeating about human rights in China, doesn't really care about that. What he cares about is textiles in North Carolina. Human rights became a very convenient thing, and we know that if they really cared about that, we wouldn't have been holding Taiwan up for so many years as the bastion of liberalism. I mean, it was under martial law until 1987. Now, Taiwan is an interesting example then because it is held up as the model of the ways in which economic reforms lead to the bolstering of a middle class that ultimately has some autonomous pressure for the legislature. I think the jury's out on whether or not that's going to happen in China. But the one thing that I would point out is that there have been a lot of reforms under the surface that many people don't know about, partly because we still think of it as an authoritarian regime, which it is. But the legislative
reforms
that
happened...
Give me an
example, Doug, if you can.
So under Zhu Rongji's tenure as sort of the steward of the economy and as premier of China in the 1990s, there were many, many laws that were passed that have, at their core... the notion of individual civil liberties. Now, as Minxin pointed out earlier, there's still the judicial branch is still sort of stated, appointed by the state and controlled in that way, and so there's not a clear line to the development of that. But there are 100,000 lawyers in China now, and it is a burgeoning area of development that is really placing at its core notions of individual civil liberties, even if the state is still an authoritarian government that can't control it. I mean, the final piece of that is that on some level, if we come back to this issue, that the government has no choice. If you take, for example, the village-level elections, which have been in place since about 1987, they didn't put those in play for altruistic or democratic reasons. They put it in play because the Communist Party was falling apart in the village areas and they were going to have a rebellion on their hands if they didn't give people some self-determination. But the consequence of that is that for 10 years, they've been developing this sort of micro-level or local-level institutions of voting and democratic self-determination that I think has had a much bigger impact in the countryside than we realize.
Okay, Minxin Pei, though, back on the point that Peter was making.
Well, I think it's a very important point because for Americans, value is always a key issue in foreign policy. I think when we look at China, we must remember several things. The first is that over the last 25 years, reform and China's opening to the outside world have together done a lot to improve human rights in China. China 25 years ago was like North Korea today. And the North Koreans, when they enter China, they think it's paradise. So that gives you some idea of how far China has come along. Of course, for us, China has not done enough to satisfy our high standards. But this does not mean that China has not progressed. Second, that China is really a huge, huge country, and I wonder where Peter went in China. Individual violations of human rights are found in all countries. In China, that's especially problematic. Take the issue of human organs harvesting. The government in Beijing has strict policies against that. However, at the local level, because it's profit-driven, people commit that kind of crimes or activities. Well, even in the U.S., UCLA, they sell dead body parts. So we cannot use that instance, isolate instance, and say, well, in the U.S. it's prevalent. So I think on the whole, the U.S. has to maintain both vigilance right. on those individual human rights violation issues and then maintain engagement, because history has shown that if you want to ensure progress in China, you must maintain engagement with China politically, economically, and culturally. Otherwise, you're going to be faced with a North Korea, which is 50 times bigger.
Let's go to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Michael's joining us on the line. Michael, thanks for waiting.
Thank you. No problem. A real quick question is, you know, we've talked about the political implications of China's growth domestically here in the United States and with and what may or may not be going on in China. What does all this mean geopolitically, you know, in terms of, let's say some of these assumptions hold, that China will grow 7 or 8% a year in two or three generations. Do you think we'll return to a a dual superpower world, or will China surpass? And what does that mean for America's place in regards to protecting?
That's a great question, Michael, because it's certainly one of the issues that's being spoken of in the party plenum, the idea of getting more high-tech equipment into the Chinese army. Now, Minxin and Doug, I've got just a couple of minutes left on the program, so maybe I could give each one of you just a minute to look at the possibility of where China's going with this in a grander scale.
Oh, in 20 years, even if we assume 7% growth rate, China's economic size will equal that to the U.S. But on a per capita basis, the Chinese people will be still relatively poor, about one-fifth of the American per capita income. China will still have a huge military gap with the U.S. China will be 10-20 years behind the U.S. militarily. China's technology will be better than it has today, but will still be many years by. In other words, a dual superpower situation will never materialize.
Doug, do you agree?
Yeah, I largely agree. I mean, I think that it's always important to keep the numbers in perspective here. I mean, when we talk about the growth of the Chinese military, as a proportion of the economy in terms of spending, it has not grown. It's just that the economy has grown. And in addition, in terms of real numbers, the difference is just ridiculous. I mean, China spends about somewhere between $13 and $20 billion a year on its military, and we spend, you know, $350 billion. So, I mean, there's a difference in terms of that power that is just not going to, I think, lead to a real superpower dynamic. But the Chinese economy is going to continue to grow, and it's going to be the real counterbalance probably to the U.S. economy.
I want to thank you both for helping us with our own understanding of what's happening in that country. Doug, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Doug Guthrie is author of Dragon in a Three-Piece Suit, and Minxin Pei, thank you very much for being with us as well.
My pleasure.
Minxin Pei, co-director of the China Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We also talked with Russell Flannery, the Forbes bureau chief, and Rob Gifford, NPR's China correspondent. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.